Good morning, everyone. I am convening today's House Revenue Committee. Welcome. We have another day of thrilling testimony on heart-stoppingly exciting subjects that are massively important. The latter, not the former, probably. Today, our subject is going to be reconnect and basically our interface, our current in-time interface and our last year's interface with federal tax changes in taxes and our disconnect and possible reconnect. We're going to start this morning with Chris Allenack going through sort of the flyover of where we are and give us some numbers to sort of frame this, then we're going to hear from the CPA.
Chris? Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. In your packet of paper, you should have a one-pager entitled Preliminary Estimates for Federal Connect Provisions. Those are the numbers that I'll be getting to in a minute. Just by way of background, where we stand with connection to federal law is there are two pieces. There are provisions that need to be tied to a date specific, and those provisions are tied to December 31st, 2009. And there are provisions that affect taxable income. And for there, we are not tied to tax year 2010. So we aren't tied to any of the changes in 2010 that affect tax year 2010. Beginning 1/1/11, we are back. We have been back on a rolling reconnect for taxpayers whose tax years start on or after 1/1/11. And so, to try and break the discussion and the numbers into the two relevant pieces and that sheet, there's a column that's titled 2010 Reconnect Impact, and that would be the revenue impact of reconnecting to the provisions that affect tax year 2010. That's why they are negative numbers. We are not currently tied to those, and tying to them would be a revenue loss. That's why they are negative. And then in the second column is disconnect impact for 2011-13, and we are currently tied to those provisions. So the policy choice or the discussion would be to actively disconnect from them, and in disconnecting from them, there would be a revenue raiser, a revenue increase, and that's why those numbers are positive. Now, there are a few major bills that passed in 2010 that affected many provisions, and that's reflected in the book that Bob Karas will go through. I tried to focus on the, in terms of numbers, those with the largest impact. So the six or so that are listed on this page aren't the only ones that have revenue impacts, but they are the largest, so they're essentially put in descending order. And generally speaking, if they're not on the page, they look, there are another two dozen or so provisions that have a revenue impact, but look to have a revenue impact of less than $1 million or so. So just touching on these briefly through the page, the one at the top is bonus depreciation. And the policies passed in the two different bills in 2010, there was a 50% bonus depreciation for property placed in service in 2010. That was passed in the Small Business Jobs Act. And then in the big tax extenders bill that passed in December, that modified bonus depreciation and created a 100% bonus depreciation or expensing for property placed in service and between 9/9/10 and 12/31/11, and then extended the 50% bonus depreciation for tax year for property placed in service in 2012. So the two pieces of the impact here, the minus $34 million for reconnecting to the 2010 relates to the 50% bonus depreciation placed in service by 9/8/2010, and part of the 100% expensing if it was placed in service in 2010. And even for some corporations, if the property were placed in service in 2011, if they're still in their 2010 tax year, we're not tied to it. So, for example, there could be two corporations putting property placed in service today on February 3rd, and if one of those corporations has a calendar year tax year, so they're in their 2011 tax year, we are tied to that. If the other corporation is on a fiscal year that's similar, the July to June fiscal year, they're still in their 2010 tax year, and we would not be tied to the provision for those taxpayers.
Wow.
So that adds another wrinkle. And then moving down the Section 179 expensing, there have been a lot of changes to this over the years. And here, the two parameters are this maximum and the threshold levels. And the maximum amount is the amount of that can be expensed at one time in the given year. And then the threshold is that amount gets phased out for property that has a greater value. So, for example, that first category, property that is of up to $500,000 in value can be expensed in the first year. And if the value exceeds $2 million, it starts to get phased out. So those are the two parameters there. And the minus $18 million is for tax year 2010, and then there would be a plus 30 for 2011 and 2012. The tuition expense is an above-the-line deduction for personal income tax filers. And this is a case, again, where they got extended for tax years 10 and 11, so we're not tied to the 2010 provision, so that's the minus $10 million impact. And then we are tied to the tax year 2011, so that would be the plus 10. And then the health care coverage for adults. This is the provision in the health care reform that modified law pertaining to young adults. Prior law had been that these dependents could be covered on the health plans of their parents up if they were under the age of 19 or under the age of 24 if they were a full-time student. The health care reform bill increased that to up to the age of 26 or under the age of 27. And that was for part of 2010 and then moving forward. So there's a slight impact in 2010 and then an impact in 11 and 13. And that's been one of the trickier ones to estimate, just in terms of solid numbers to go on. And then the last two there, we get down to policies that start having a revenue impact in the $1 million range. And the first one there are distributions from IRAs that are given to certain charities. They would be exempt from tax. And then a different kind of depreciation for restaurants that would shorten their otherwise time frame. And so there's about $1 million impact either way there. So these are the large impacts in 2010. So those total to about $65 million. And in 11-13, those total right there, $135 million. One thing I would add, I've labeled these preliminary. Tomorrow there is a quarterly meeting pertaining to the revenue forecast process where we meet with some CPAs up in Portland. And so I'll be trying to get some feedback on what they're seeing from their taxpayers.
Questions for Chris? Same one.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm taking it from this that where you have written provision, you're meaning the federal provision that we're either tying to or not.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question on the bonus and the 179 numbers on the impact. Is that in isolation of each, or are those contemplating behavior of taxpayers that may take advantage of both 179 and bonus depreciation? Or are they separate? Or
they should. The estimates are mainly shared down from the Joint Committee on Taxation, and my understanding is they account for some behavioral response of who might jump from one to the other.
Or both. Okay, thank you.
Other questions? I have a couple, Chris. So the committee knows, the chair and I are trying to kind of take the reconnect 2010 and anything going forward in 2011 is sort of separate issues, but these numbers are on here to help you, guide you. Question, Chris, on the tuition expense, all of these on the 2010 reconnect are roughly half of the biennial 11-13 numbers, except the tuition one, it's the same, 10. And it's 1 year versus 2 years. Why is it higher?
That provision, it's actually 1 year in each year. It got extended for 2 years, tax year 10 and tax year 11.
Oh, and then it ends.
And then it ends.
So it is a 1 year. Okay, well, that explains that.
But there is, that's a good point. Depending on the provision, there is that variability. Some got extended for 2 years and sometimes the 2 years are tax years 11 and 12. And sometimes the tax years are 10 and 11. And then sometimes they affect all three tax years.
Yeah. So, our simple tax code. And I also would like to remind the committee that in the bonus depreciation, and I'm less familiar with the 179 expenses, but both of these are timing issues. It's the feds have accelerated this. These are timing issues as much as anything. Go ahead.
Chris, is the thank you, Madam Chair. The 2011-13 is the biennium, not the calendar years.
Correct.
Thank you.
And these, I should add, these are orders of magnitude in terms of trying to. There are certain challenges in terms of splitting out the revenue impacts and the timing. For example, any of the 2010 impacts, depending on when action is taken, that could affect revenues in this biennium. It could all be in next biennium, depending on the timing and how taxpayers respond, which is, as the chair was pointing out, that's a big issue. Right now, people are trying to file their tax return, and there's certain information on the Department of Revenue's website about how to file right now, and there are a lot of questions out there about how to file. So that's one of the nuances about the timing of the impact, whether it would actually happen in this biennium or in the next biennium.
Well,
yes, thank you, and I apologize for being late this morning, but so you may well have addressed this, but is the time frame within which we should act is prior to, I guess every CPA would want us to act by tomorrow. Is that a correct statement?
From the CPAs that I've heard from who call me at home, I would say that was an accurate statement.
So follow up to that, or in addition,
yes,
to that, what is the normal? Do we as a group try to act before March 15th? Or do we, what's driving our decision is my question.
I think you've hit on it. We are in the middle of tax season for everybody. Not the CPAs are working, but they're working for clients who are in the middle of tax service. So that is why this is the first thing on our agenda. Normal is a rolling reconnect. When we disconnected from that, we sort of charged ourselves to deal with these issues promptly, and that's what we're about. Does that answer your question?
Madam Co-Chair, partially. The issue is, do we as a committee need to identify a date and then say we're going to get it done by that date, or is there something else that we're waiting for to happen before we can do so?
We set our own timelines, as you fully know. The Senate is also hearing these same issues. We will be working with the Senate to get closure, and that's why we are kind of concentrating on 2010 right now, to get the closure around that before we deal with further reconnect issues. Believe me, we are hearing the clock ticking.
Thank you.
Thank you. And, yes.
Thank you. If I might shed some light on the sense of urgency, many of the taxpayers using most of these do have some time, as long as it's by extension time, April 15th. However, the health care coverage for young adults is very sensitive. That impacts many families who may have had their children covered under health care in 2010. W-2s have already been issued for them, and many of them are lower income. They do not know how to file their tax returns and are really heavily weighted upon their filing of the returns for cash. And in this down economy, that is the one that sticks out the most to me, to those families impacted, as far as creating a tremendous sense of urgency.
Thank you. With that, I would like to bring up Bob Karras. He is a representative of the Oregon Society of CPAs. They traditionally review tax changes and come before this committee early in the session and give their help and their expertise, for which we are deeply grateful to you. They are in the middle of their tax season and very busy. I've asked Bob to kind of go through, and he's given more details in this document, but I've asked him to give us about a half an hour of what this looks like and what their world looks like. And Bob, welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair Berger. Chair Barnhart, Chair Berger, members of the committee, my name is Robert Karras. I'm a CPA in Portland, Oregon. And as Chair Berger indicated, I'm here representing the Oregon Society of Certified Public Accountants.
We have prepared a booklet, which is for your future reference, regarding all of the federal tax law changes that occurred during 2010, which Chris Alnock has so... thank you, Chris, by the way. Thank you very much, because this is great, getting this whole subject warmed up. But there have been a number of federal tax law changes, and as Chris has said, we're not connected to any of those as the way the law stands right now for 2010. And we are connected to anything that is in place for 2011, the way the law stands right now. So rather than go through this book, I was preparing for this presentation last night, this testimony last night, and I thought, you know, what is the most important thing that you individuals would like to know, or the committee would like to know, about the federal tax law changes? And I came up with my top 10 list, and I've given you that. I'm not a fan of David Letterman, but he has a way of getting your attention, and that's what I'm trying to do here. And for better or for worse, Chris has already stolen my thunder on the biggest items on the list. So thanks so much. But that's okay, because it never hurts to say it more than once. These are very difficult issues, and they are not the kind of issues that my clients are comfortable understanding right out of the gate. And because the legislature is no more expert in the area of accounting than my clients are, not that that's a bad thing. I don't expect that we're going to grab all these things instantaneously. But Chair Berger, you did make a good point in that the biggest items on Chris's list are timing in nature. In other words, we get the federal government has hit the tax revenues with a gigantic amount of stimulus, and over the course of the next 7 years, they're going to get that money back in the form of higher tax collections. So let's take a look at the first one. Chris has already covered, this is the bonus depreciation, which is running at 50% for fixed assets added from January 1st and until September 8th of 2010. And then for anything added, any qualifying assets added from September 9th, 2010 until December 31st of 2011, we're going to get 100% bonus depreciation. So what that means is that if a client of mine places a piece of equipment into service, they can simply expense the entire thing. Ordinarily, what they would be required to do would be to capitalize it and amortize it over 5 to 7 to 12 to 15, depending on the type of asset, years. This is a tremendous amount of stimulus, and that's the whole idea. The federal government is trying to get business back on its feet, so business can start hiring people again. And I think that there's been a certain amount of success in that. Obviously, as a CPA Society member, our drumbeat always is the concept of reconnect. And why do we emphasize reconnect so much? It's because we don't want our clients coming back to us and saying, you didn't do this right. The more complicated Oregon tax law is, the more Oregon law diverges from federal tax law, the more complicated our job becomes, because now we have to think, okay, this is the way you do it for federal, this is the way you do it for state. And we have to remember those things rolling out into the future, like, for example, in the area of depreciation. We can't just forget about it in 2011 and say, okay, that's bygones. We're going to have to remember this over the remainder of the life of that asset, that our depreciation schedule for federal purposes is going to look different than the depreciation schedule for state. So that's something that we have to keep thinking about. People who are coming from out of state advising their clients who do business here in Oregon, who file Oregon income tax returns, they're even less likely to understand these nuances. California, they've probably got figured out. Why? California is such a big state. Everybody has to understand California who's going to practice in multi-state taxation. But Oregon's sort of, the poor stepchild in the West Coast, and our tax laws may be not as well known among among people, practitioners from out of the state. So that's the reason for the drumbeat. Simply just to keep it simple, so that your revenue stream is a predictable one, so the Department of Revenue's job is a well-defined one and an easily defined one, and so the taxpayer's job and their advisors is an easy one too. The next item on the list is Section 179, expensing, and the limit for 2010 and 2011, as Chris has said, is $500,000. The phase-out is something that's out there. The clients that I advise are not likely to encounter that phase-out. The larger manufacturing concerns in the state of Oregon, Schnitzer Group or Precision Cast Parts, mm-hmm. you would see them hitting that limitation and beginning to lose that $500,000. But they've got bonus depreciation. depreciation in their back pocket. So it's like, who cares if you run out of that limitation? The only thing you have to be careful of with bonus depreciation is that it's got to be new property. But that's a wrinkle. The point is, $500,000 for most of us, that's going to, it's $500,000, period. And then the law, as Chris pointed out, raised the limit in the future to $125,000. Without the law changes that happened in 2010, that limitation would have been only $25,000, and Oregon would have conformed, presumably would have conformed to that as well. Again, without conformity in the year 2010, Oregon taxpayers are not going to be able to take advantage on their Oregon returns of that $500,000, and instead they're going to be forced to push that, push those deductions out into the future on their own Oregon income tax returns. The third item on my list isn't really a tax law change thing, and it's kind of not. And it's one that we've been discussing with in the CPA Society and the taxation team. And that is that it's sort of one of these unintended consequences. And I want to thank our lobbyist, Rob Douglas, for pointing out that the only law that can't be broken is the law of unintended consequences, which I think is kind of funny. That's three things now. We have death, taxes, and unintended consequences. For years, we've been solidly behind the proposition in the state of Oregon that for an individual, now we're only talking about individuals here, because individuals, we have to make it simpler for individuals. So for individuals, the amount of a net operating loss is the same on your federal return as it is on the state return. Now, what do we mean by net operating loss? It's very simple. You've lost so much money in your business activities that your taxable income is negative, and the federal tax law gives you the opportunity to do something creative with that loss, which is you don't just suck it up. You can go back 2 years, and now you can go back up to 5 years and recoup taxes that you paid in those prior tax years. That's a tremendous advantage. Here I am. I'm suffering. You know, my business has lost so much money. I've had to dump, you know, all my net worth into this business. At the very least, I can go back and recoup some of the taxes that I paid in prior years, get that money back into my pocket so I can keep the doors open. And Oregon law is exactly the same as federal when it comes to individual net operating losses. That means that if a person has a federal net operating loss of $20,000 or $50,000 and carries it back 5 years, that's what they'll do on their Oregon return too. It's the exact same dollar amount. Now, here's the unintended consequence. And we knew this was going to be a problem when we switched over to this concept, because I've been around long enough where there used to be differences between federal and state for an individual. And the funny wrinkle is this bonus depreciation and the Section 179 depreciation. If a taxpayer calculates their net operating loss and part of their portfolio of assets that contributes income to that is a business ownership interest, like a limited liability company, and then that limited liability company claimed bonus depreciation, that bonus depreciation has been factored into the calculation of that net operating loss, which is then being carried back. So on their Oregon tax return, the individual has secured the benefit of the net operate of the bonus depreciation despite the prohibition against it. And that's okay, because we've told them that that's okay. So what do they do? Because remember, like Chair Berger indicated, these are all timing differences, and there's going to be implications that flow out into the future. You've already secured the bonus depreciation you weren't entitled to. Now what? What do you do in year two? Well, the Department of Revenue has issued an informal policy, at least of the CPA Society, maybe more broadly, but I just know that I heard it, you know, I heard it from them, that in years 2 through 7, you would simply disregard the adjustment to depreciation expense that you would have otherwise been entitled to. You don't have any basis for claiming that adjustment to depreciation expense. Remember that your Oregon, without this net operating loss, this taxpayer is going to have a big positive adjustment on their Oregon return in year one, and then a series of negative adjustments that zero everything out, so that when you come to the end of the asset, your state to federal difference has zeroed out. They've already, but this person with the net operating loss has already secured the and escaped that positive adjustment up front. They're not entitled to get those negative adjustments either. And you think, well, that's pretty simple. We can track that. But the problem is with a limited liability company, let's say I'm just a 10% owner, and there's other people out there in that limited liability company, and they haven't had net operating losses. And in year two, my K-1 comes in from the limited liability company. That's the document where I know how much income and deductions I'm going to report on my personal return, the result of my ownership in that company. And that K-1 is going to say, oh, and you have a subtraction of X representing, and it just says a subtraction of X. You don't even know what it is. You just know that you have a subtraction of X. Maybe there's some anecdotal supporting schedule indicating that that's related to depreciation. Well, the problem there then is that that's not the only asset that that LLC put into service. It put into service assets in year zero, in year one, and year two. And that net number that's coming through is that the state to federal difference is a composite of all those different things. And I have to go back to that LLC and I have to break it apart. And I, you know, me, you know, with my little green eye shade, we can't have that one. Well, all right, so the question is, do we really love conformity between, and my lobbyist back there is going to shoot me for saying this, but do we really love conformity between federal and state net operating losses so much that we're willing to walk away from that we're willing to have to put up with that? Because, you know, just so you know, there's probably going to be mistakes being made, not by me naturally, but there are going to be mistakes. There are going to be mistakes that are going to get made. And if one of my clients moves to another CPA, guaranteed there's going to be mistakes, because that next guy isn't going to understand this issue, or they're not going to be tracking it the way I've been tracking it. Because when in my return, I'm going to set up a carry forward schedule, and I'm not even going to need that information for the LLC after year one. So just so you know, that's one of the issues out there. So I'm kind of raising your awareness,
Bob,
on that one.
Yes, stop right there, because I have a feeling it engendered some questions, and I don't want to go on to the next 10 items before
Sure. We've
kind of vetted this a little bit. Representative Brewer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have a bill drafted to address clarification language on this specific issue, because I do believe as a state, while I like it as a CPA and allows my clients to save tax money, I do believe that we are leaving money on the table. I don't even know the magnitude, but I think it's I don't even know if anybody's been tracking the magnitude, but it is an issue. And so I have a bill being drafted. It's imperfect. I haven't reviewed it yet. I think I've got it back from LC yesterday, and I would love to get some feedback on it, but it is an issue.
Thank you. And that was it. Further questions? My question was, how big of a universe of tax returns are we talking about here? I'll be honest with you, Bob. I didn't understand all that, but I'm glad you did. And
double dipping is the effect.
Yeah, I get that. But so, how big of a universe?
Wow, that's hard to say. You remember that the majority of the businesses, I believe, in the state of Oregon are flow through entities, which means that they are going to have this kind of an impact. They may not, however, have more than one shareholder. Again, the majority of the businesses in Oregon are small businesses, and they're closely held, which means that there's a very tight group of people that are all, quote, insiders with respect to the information coming from the LLC.
But they'd also have to be the kind of a company that would purchase equipment.
That's true.
And a lot of small businesses are service-oriented. And they wouldn't necessarily buy equipment.
Exactly right. And for my clients, I'm steering them as long as their fixed asset additions are within the Oregon threshold, which for 2010 is $134,000 for this Section 179. I'm steering them towards Section 179 depreciation, so I don't wind up with state to federal differences. So there are ways to plan your way around this. If I just blindly went into bonus depreciation, I'm guaranteed to have a state to federal difference. But if I choose my path correctly, I don't even have this issue. How big of a problem? I really don't know. But Representative Brewer, I'm appreciative that you're thinking about this issue. Thank you.
Representative Boyne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the non-CPAs in the audience, if there are any, does Section 179 include real property, or is it only equipment?
Section 179 generally includes only personal property, equipment. There are some kinds of real property that Section 179 does apply to, and I'll be talking about some of those. But also things that aren't structural components of a building. Things, there are certain kinds of real property that would not be, that would be eligible for 179 expensing.
Thank you.
Representative Brewer.
I was going to say the real solution to that issue is to totally reconnect on bonus and 179, and then the issue goes away.
I have made that comment before. That comment. Okay. All right, I think we're ready to go on. We got pie number three.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's okay because these ones are the hard ones,
yeah.
And the rest of these we can fly through, and rightly so. The next one, which is item number four on my top 10 changes, is another fairly narrow one, but another sort of troubling one, and that's the basis of an asset acquired from a decedent. If a person dies in 2010, the federal tax law as it stands right now allows the person inheriting that property to receive a basis in that property. And I promise I'll go into all this, but I'm just going to summarize the issue. Allows that person to have a basis in the property equal to the fair market value of that property when the person died, when the person who left it to them died. What is basis? Basis means your starting point for determining gain or loss when you sell a thing. My basis in my house is normally what I paid for my house plus any permanent improvements that I made to it. So I have a house. I paid, $200,000 for it. I made $50,000 worth of improvements to it. My basis is $250,000. If I sell, I compare that basis to the proceeds, and I decide whether I've made money or lost money. That's what basis is. In the case of somebody who's inherited something from a decedent, that's not what you paid for. You didn't pay anything. Grandpa gave it to you. He died and it wound up in your hands. So the basis in the hands of a decedent is fair market value. That's the rule. And it's always been the rule ever since I can remember, maybe the 1930s. The difference is that Oregon law is predicated on the way the federal law was supposed to look for 2010. As it stood on December 31st of 09. And when we stood on the precipice of December 31st of 09, the rule for 2010 wasn't carryover basis for property in the hands of a decedent. It wasn't for stepped-up fair market value. It was for what's called carryover basis. And carryover basis means this. I've inherited a house from Grandpa's estate. And now the house was worth, let's say, $1 million. I can't stop there. I have to look and see what Grandpa's basis was in that house, because now that's now my basis in that house. Now it's modified carryover. There's some ifs, ands, or buts about that rule that even muddy the water further, but let's just pretend that we're done with that whole issue. I've inherited a house from Grandpa. It's Grandpa died in 2010. It's now in my portfolio. I'm not living there. It's not my house. I don't care about it, really. It's just an asset that I own. It's got a fair market value of $1 million, but my basis for Oregon income tax purposes in that house is $250,000. So when I go to sell that house, I'm probably going to sell it at fair market value. Let's say I really don't need the house at all. I'm just going to sell it. I'm going to get the $1 million, and I'm going to keep that. And that's going to be tax-free on my federal return because I have a fair market value. I've sold it for $1 million, which is what it was worth when Grandpa died, and my basis in the house is $1 million. So I have no gain or loss to report on my income tax return. I'm finished on my federal return. There's no tax implication. But on my Oregon return, I've only got a $250,000 basis, and I've got $750,000 to pay income taxes on. That's easy because I sold it the year after Grandpa died. Now, suppose I waited 10 years, and my accountant comes in who's only got 5 years under his belt or her belt, and she's up from California and doesn't have any idea about this rule. And that rule only existed for the year 2010 because for the year 2011, under this rolling reconnect, and I'm not going to address any of this stuff. This is all the whether we adopt rolling reconnect is the domain of people smarter and more hardworking than I am. But starting on January 1st, I mean that sincerely. You guys, you have my admiration. Starting on January 1st of 2011, we're going to be reconnected to federal statute. Federal statute says fair market value is the basis. So we're going to have to remember that asset in the hands of the person who inherited it is going to be different for federal than it is for state. That's just another one of those traps for the unwary that we would like to see go away. And how we make that go away, I just don't know. But it's in the scheme of things, I believe that the revenue impact would be slight, and the degree of noncompliance would be considerable, simply out of inadvertence. So that's item number four. Five, I didn't, you know, Chris, thank you for pointing out this thing about tuition expenses. I didn't realize that, that, and that's the third item on Chris's list for above-the-line deduction for tuition expenses. I had no idea that the revenue impact would be so significant for the state of Oregon. So I appreciate him calling attention to that particular issue. But my item number five was tax-free health benefits for adult children over the age of 27. Chris covered that one. Enhanced net operating loss carrybacks. We sort of covered that in number three when I was talking about that. Item number seven is startup costs. When a smaller business starts up, normally it incurs things like legal fees and accountants' fees and maybe appraiser fees and things like that. And they're trying to get, and maybe consultants, they're trying to get the business off the ground. And those are called startup costs. And in the old days, you had to capitalize those and you had to amortize them over some period of time. And then the Fed said, no, you're going to amortize them over 15 years because we're tired of arguing with you about it. And then they said, no, I'll tell you what, we'll just throw you the first $5,000. You can deduct the first $5,000 right up front and we'll call it good. And anything over $5,000, you'll have to capitalize and amortize over the 15 years. And then last year they said, no, we think $10,000 because we'd like more businesses. They're the engine of job growth in the country. We want to see more businesses start up, and $10,000 is going to be the cap. For 2010, we're not connected to that change. For 2010, any business that has over $5,000 of startup expenses is going to wind up with a different deduction on their federal return than on their state return. And those differences, like with bonus and Section 179, are going to persist only for a 15-year period of time. Earned income credit enhancements, item number eight. Various features of the federal tax law have made it easier and more productive to claim the earned income credit. More people are going to be eligible for it. More people are going to be able to earn more money and still get the earned income credit. People are going to be able to use more children in determining the amount of the earned income credit. All these things are going to increase the amount of earned income credit that the federal government is allowing to be claimed by lower income people. The state of Oregon is automatically connected to that because the way the state credit is determined is simply as a percentage of the federal credit allowed. So this is something that's not a law change that Oregon has to do anything about. We're simply getting sucked along into it because the way Oregon law works, we're simply taking 6% of whatever you get on your federal return. And, you know, it's interesting, too, about the earned income credit, and that is you'd be surprised who qualifies for it. If you have my practice specialty is small business owners, not low-income individuals. And a few years ago, I had a whole maybe a half a dozen people that qualified for the earned income credit because their small business had lost so much money that it sucked their income down to the point where all of a sudden the EIC popped up on their return, and I was quite surprised by that. I expect to see that again in 2010 with small business owners. Next item is the item number nine, the little $250 deduction for teacher classroom expenses. The federal government allows teachers to deduct $250 of their out-of-pocket costs as an above-the-line deduction. That means that they don't even have to file itemized deductions. They don't have to worry about the disallowance of miscellaneous itemized deductions. They simply get the first $250 as a little thank you for being a hardworking classroom teacher. The state of Oregon for 2010, that was scheduled to go away as of December 31st, 2009. That was supposed to go away during 2010. Late in the 2010 year, the Congress reinstituted that rule. We're not connected to that. If we don't do something about it, those teachers will have a state to federal difference on their Oregon returns. And last but not least, item number 10, qualified real property. Representative Wan, this is one of the areas where a piece of real estate would be eligible for expensing under Section 179. A few years ago, the Congress decided that certain kinds of leasehold improvements should be eligible for a shorter depreciation life than normal. Normally, when I'm a tenant running a business out of my landlord's property, if I make some significant leasehold improvements to that property, I would be required to recover the cost of that over a 39-year period of time. The law changed to allow 15-year recovery of that. And for 2010 and 2011, we can recover those types of things, leasehold improvements, and we can also deduct retail and restaurant improvements over a 15-year period of time. And as to the Section 179 expensing, there is one that isn't. I can't remember which one it is now, but at least two of these three categories of real property improvements are eligible for up to $250,000 of expensing under Section 179. Oregon is connected to none of this, so that on your Oregon return, we're going to simply be amortizing those real estate improvements over a 39-year period of time with no upfront expensing permitted at all. And you'd think, and we're not talking about structural modifications. The shell of the building can't be touched. We're not talking about common area things. But let's think, I'm Macy's and I have a big property in Clackamas Town Center. I could gut that all the way to the walls and expense the first $250,000 of it and of those improvements to do that and recoup the rest of it under 15 years rather than be forced to more than double that recovery period. So those are my top 10 list items. And we're just about run out of time.
Bob, that wasn't a hard and fast. I was just so. Questions? Yes, Representative Moore.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you're taking this bonus depreciation to what? Let's say the Macy's example, and you've got your $250,000 that you get to take in year one, and let's say the expense. Is $1 million, just so that we can throw some numbers out. So in year one, you get to take the $250,000 as an expense. So
that's correct.
That's a 100% in year one.
Mm-hmm.
And you're left with $750,000. Do you begin your depreciation schedule in year two, or do you take that $750,000, move it to a different schedule, and then start your amortization depreciation?
You begin the year that the asset goes in service. That's always the rule.
Okay, so you get the $250,000 is an addition. I mean, it's a full addition.
That's correct. That's not an in lieu of. That's correct. Yeah, I see your question. Yes, absolutely correct.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions? Thank you very, very much.
You bet.
There's a lot more in this document. Have fun reading. I think Representative Air Brewer, I'm sure, will find it stirring.
No one finds it stirring.
Well, we appreciate you. We appreciate you coming in, and we appreciate your willingness to help with this whole issue and your service.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and the Society is grateful for the opportunity to be of service to the state of Oregon.
We'll ask you again, and again and again and again.
Perfect. I appreciate that. Thank you very much, and Representative Barnhart, too. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm going to call in Denny Wheeler. Normally, people who live over 100... Oh, I haven't opened a public hearing. I have. We have to open up. Thank you. I've just been reminded, Denny. You can't come up. We have a bill before us, and in order to testify on the bill, I have to open a public hearing on the bill. And so I, at this time, open a public hearing on House Bill 2535. And with that said, Denny Wheeler, please come up and talk to us. Normally we invite people who have come from far away to come up first, and we welcome you and are happy you're here. Please give your name for the record.
Okay, my name is Denny, spelling D-E-N-N-I-E, last of Wheeler, common spelling. I am a certified public accountant. The excellent testimony that just preceded me, I have nothing to do with, and I am pleased to follow it, although in theatrics that would be called a hard act to follow. As a CPA, my practice is almost entirely tax-related. I am one of, I believe, to be only three non-attorneys in the state of Oregon to be admitted to practice before the United States Tax Court Bar. And I do quite a bit of representation work for clients in tax controversies. And another thing, I do this I'm saying this solely to give the committee background. Also, in 2007, 2008, the Oregon Department of Revenue hired me as a contract instructor in partnership tax law. Again, I want to echo the prior speaker's comments on limited liability companies, that sometimes you get information and you just don't know what a whole lot from the K-1. Briefly, I came here today. I am not being compensated or reimbursed by any person or organization. This is entirely a personal opinion. I'm not speaking for any person or organization other than myself. But the number one thing I wish to state to this committee is please reconnect. I didn't have your phone number, so I couldn't call you.
No, I have CPAs who do.
Yeah. So at this public hearing, please reconnect. The House Bill 2535 under consideration, I think, is a very good bill as written. But again, just to reiterate, please reconnect. And again, the timing of the reconnect to help taxpayers, tax practitioners, and the Oregon Department of Revenue, I think it is imperative. The one change that I would suggest be made to the bill is on page 2 and 3 of my my letter. I tried to keep this very brief, as committee members and the prior speaker have pointed out. The tax laws enacted by Congress in 2010 are extensive, and I was going to bring the actual text books. The bill that the prior speaker referred to being passed in December, the book published by Thomson Reuters is literally 2 inches thick. And so we have two sets of tax laws to deal with under present Oregon law for 1 year. With, again, as Co-Chair Barnhart and others have pointed out, significant revenue impacts to the state of Oregon are actually timing issues, not total revenue issues. But the proposed change, which I offer to this committee, is to allow the Oregon Department of Revenue in a tax controversy to use its discretion whenever the federal courts have decided essentially the same issue differently. Current law, and it's cited near the bottom of page 2 in my letter, the current law directs the Department of Revenue to follow the IRS position if two federal courts have decided an issue differently. My proposal, which I hadn't had time to run by any Oregon Department of Revenue personnel until Deborah Buchanan very early this morning, she has a copy of this also, this would avoid an interesting situation where, say, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which includes Oregon, has rendered an opinion one way. So we're preparing a federal tax return in accordance with that opinion. And yet the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals decided something different, and the IRS, it almost always, very predictably, the IRS will take the least taxpayer-friendly position. And the way the Oregon revised statutes are currently written, a conscientious Department of Revenue employee is going to, well, I'm constrained to take the IRS position. And quite frankly, I would like to compliment the vast majority of Department of Revenue employees I've worked with or against. I think they're very, very good. And I wanted to keep it brief, even if it did take 4 hours to drive here from Bandon.
Thank you.
And does the any of the committee members have any questions?
Is there any questions? I have a couple of comments. Thank you. Thank you very much for your commitment to come up here and talk to us. You've added a kind of an interesting new wrinkle to the conversation, but that happens a lot around here. And and we will be in conversation about the Department of Revenue and what the implications of that are. But thank you for bringing that up, too. And we deeply appreciate your commitment to come up here and talk to us.
Well, thank you. And in the time I've been here and watched the committee work, I must say that in an hour and a half, I've definitely impressed with the attention you're giving to this matter.
we appreciate that it is a very important matter.
Yes, it is.
As most of the things we deal with.
yeah, the trivial ones don't get here.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Jim Craven, are you still here?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Craven with Tech America, the trade association representing the high-tech industry, and my inaugural testimony in here in Room A for 2011. We'll try to limit the appearances this session. I think you have had some very eloquent testimony from the previous two witnesses why trying to stay as closely connected to the federal code as possible and practicable is a really high-value goal for the state of Oregon. We support it. It hasn't always been that way. We supported the move to so-called Rolling Reconnect a decade ago, 12 years ago, whenever this body made that decision. In the last 4 to 6 years, we have occasionally diverted from that high order value, sometimes because we were afraid of what Congress might do, and we were going to adjourn and not know. Sometimes we knew what Congress did, and we decided to divert from it by cherry-picking provisions here and there. We would urge you to avoid that temptation, if possible. That's just a long-standing position from Tech America, and I think I can probably represent the general business community. You found even just this morning in a brief time, this isn't just a business issue. It affects school teachers who have got a $250 deduction hanging out there. It affects families who are trying to sort out the incredible complexity of this extension of age for kids on health care. I mean, what is the marginal value of that? You know, a lot of group health care policies are spouse or spouse plus children. If you've got one child who clearly qualifies who's 15 and one who's 26, I don't even know how people are issuing W-2s to sort this out. But again, it is something that bodes sorting out. So really just a strong attaboy for Reconnect. You know, we can't rolling Reconnect everything. We can only rolling Reconnect to definitions of income with the federal government. We are always going to be in a little bit of backward-looking catch-up. I think with annual sessions, it'll be less. We will have a chance every year to readjust that backward-looking connection date, and I would urge you to do so as we move forward. And we've done that a little bit with the last couple of special trial run special sessions. We've taken that opportunity to pick up the previous December date for connection. But it's important. I would urge you to avoid the temptation to look at a list and say, well, here's a thing. If we disconnected from this, that's a certain amount of dollars, and I could go convince the co-chairs to spend it on my favorite project. I guess I would just – it's a heck of a temptation. I guess I would urge you to avoid it. And that's my testimony. Thank you.
Questions for Jim? Thank you. Members of the committee, believe it or not, we've come to the end of our agenda. Clearly, we will be moving very quickly on this issue for obvious reasons of the previous discussion. If there's further information or things you want to come from staff, please contact us. Okay.
I just want to note that it's only 9 a.m. and that would confuse me if revenue adjourned at 9 a.m.
Well, would you like to talk tax policy for another hour and a half?
No, that,
we can have that.
Madam Chair,
that's okay.
I'm sure
I can
the
adapt
room
to
will be open. She can stay.
Yes, you can sit here and talk tax policy endlessly.
Representative Air Brewer.
Air Brewer will stay and talk. But,
I'm curious about the definition of moist snuff.
You know, please.
Snuffless tobacco.
Oh. Yeah. Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I simply wanted to make a comment. The testimony that we've heard this morning is very persuasive on a whole lot of these issues. People of Oregon added the Rolling Reconnect to the Constitution quite a while ago now. I think it was in the 70s or 80s, if I remember right, precisely because of the issues that people have, that our CPAs have raised. I just simply wanted to point out that our problem is quite different than the problem the federal government faces when it deals with economic uncertainty. And I think it's important to reduce the complexity of the tax system as much as we can reasonably do, but we need also to take into account the reality that our situation is quite different from the federal government situation. Just a couple of spots that I think are important to talk about. The first one is that the federal government, in a time of economic crisis, can go into debt on a budget in order to promote the development of the economy through stimulus. And, of course, it's been doing that right along. I am not proposing that Oregon change its rule that we have to balance the budget every 2 years. I'm not suggesting that. But the fact that we must balance our budget every 2 years and the federal government doesn't have to makes a huge difference in what we can actually manage. When the federal government decides to change tax rates in order to stimulate the economy, which it recently did in December, that doesn't affect us because it doesn't affect the definition of income. It doesn't affect the Rolling Reconnect because it doesn't affect the definition of income. When the federal government decides to change the definition of income, and that's what we've been talking about today, then it does affect us if we're connected at the time. And when the costs of those connections get large, it affects the capacity of the state to fund the programs that the state needs to fund. When they're small, it gets into the background noise of the fact that we can't estimate with exactness what our income and expenses are going to be. And while we have this idea that we're going to balance the budget to the penny in June, it never happens, and it never will. We get very close, but we don't ever get exactly there. So that really, I think, deals with two or three issues at once. One is the complexity issue. That's what we've been talking about this morning, and that's a very important issue, and I really appreciate the testimony about that. The second issue is the loss of income issue when we're dealing with things like the first couple of items on Chris's list. As you've pointed out, there are added complexities that I hadn't appreciated until a few days ago when we met earlier. But at the same time, we are talking about the possibility of significant impacts on the budget for schools, health care, and public safety when we consider reconnecting on these relatively large budget items. Some other issues that I think are important, and I harp on them a lot, but I'm going to say them again, and that is because the people in their wisdom and the legislature in its wisdom in 1999 decided to have an unequal system for managing the tax law in the legislature, we're in one of those odd places where if we act in one way, it requires a simple majority vote. If we act in a different way, it requires a 3/5 vote. And what that means is that the legislature has less capacity, less power to manage these kinds of issues. There are times when Reconnect raises money. When that happens, it requires a 3/5 vote. There are times when Reconnect costs us money, as it does in the instances we're talking about today, in that instance, it requires a simple majority vote. So all of these issues add to the complexity of our decision in ways that I don't think the CPAs have any reason to address. It's not their business. But it's something that we have to look at with some care. I think there are some other differences as well, but I don't want to belabor the point, and I think I've hit the issues that I want to talk about. In sum, I'm going to support personally a bunch of these suggested changes, and I probably will not support others because for the reasons I've indicated.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have neglected to invite any others who weren't on the list to come forward, and that was a mistake of a rookie chair.
I signed that list.
Oh, and I apologize. So it's a little out of order, but there are two of you. Let's, if you want to come up together, and because you guys know each other, and decide who goes first. And this is my rookie mistake. Didn't get a sign-up sheet, didn't give you a chance.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I, for once in my life, will take 10 seconds.
Okay.
I ask Chris.
That would be deeply appreciated,
I know,
Ralph.
And thank you, Madam Chair. I talked to Chris Alanek yesterday.
Identification.
Oh, I'm sorry. Ralph Groner. I work for AFSCME for many years. I only want to say that I asked Chris yesterday if the final explanation was done when I had to leave the Capitol to try to create 2,500 jobs to put income tax in the second largest project in Oregon, and we got a 5-0 vote out of our city council to do that. That means extra income, and that's why I had to run. So we haven't had an opportunity, Madam Chair, co-chairs, do I say, okay, I'll be
just
quiet, both of you,
and
you're both honorable and distinguished. I only have to say that we really haven't had an opportunity, at least my union, to peruse all of these give and takes, so we would appreciate future opportunity for the folks out here to take a look at these things and maybe support some and not others or whatever. So we appreciate your time and my favorite committee, so thank you.
For the record, my name is Arthur Towers. I'm the political director for Service Employees Union Local 503. Thank you for the opportunity to come visit with you. The only point I'd like to add is to amplify on something that Co-Chair Barnhart mentioned. Our union represents frontline care providers for seniors and people with physical and developmental disabilities. We represent a number of workers in the healthcare field. And any action you take is multiplied by the loss of, or forfeiture really, of federal funds that would not come to Oregon to stimulate our state's economy. On the federal match rate for Medicaid programs, which is long-term care for seniors and people with disabilities, as well as health care, is $2.66 for every dollar that we invest in that area in, between now and June 30th. Starting July 1, the match rate is $1.66. So I just wanted to flag that the order of magnitude of what we're talking about here is much larger than it may appear on the surface. In the governor's recommended budget, the depth of the cut is nearly, I want to say, $900 million general fund in these areas, which is over $2 billion total funds. And so I just wanted to add the heads up about the nature of what we're talking about here could be much greater if the money we're talking about is applied to programs that qualify for the federal match. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you. And in the future, I'll get that piece of paper ahead and we'll be making rookie mistakes, I hope. Anything else? We will be coming back to this subject, obviously, and I would like to hear from each of you, and I think my co-chair would, on your thoughts on this. Okay? So I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2535 and give you a little bit of time. Close the Revenue Committee meeting.
Good.